committee will come to order. There's a quorum present. Clerk will note the roll. We'll begin by an motion to approve minutes for March 23rd, 2016. Representative Gruenhagen moves approval of minutes for March 23rd. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First up, we have House File 564. Members, we heard 564 in finance last session and laid it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Hamilton moves House File 564 be taken from the table to bring the bill before the committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. We have the bill before us. Representative Hamilton will move House File 564 to be laid over. Representative Hamilton, I understand you do have a DE1 amendment.
I do, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer up a DE1 amendment at this time.
All right. We have the DE1 author's amendment before us to get it into the shape that Representative Hamilton would like. Is there any questions on the DE1 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that there are some significant differences between the DE1 and the original bill, and I wonder if this would be a good time before we vote on the DE1 if we could have some explanation of what those are.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and I'm sure that Representative Hamilton or a testifier would be happy to go through the specific changes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We'll bring down an individual walk-through changes.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. If you could march through some of the top-line changes for the DE1 amendment that's before the committee and not yet voted on. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson from ARM, and ARM is a member of the Best Life Alliance, and I appreciate you bringing the bill before you. I'll do my best to reflect some of the changes. Last year, there were differences between the House and the Senate. I'm trying to recall as it came out of the House. But one of the major components last year was a reform element, quality component. Actually, I'm going back to 2014, and I believe the bill last year also had that component. I'm stumbling around, but the major difference moving forward this year is to create two reform elements. One is a quality component, which is also included in the bill that was adopted in 2014. And to reflect the reforms that the state is engaging in under Olmstead, a person-centered component. The way the money works in the bill, and I anticipate there'll be some discussion around that, is that it calls for, like last year's bill, a 5% increase. It changes how the money would work in terms of the two, the quality component and the person-centered component. Now, every provider that's eligible will get 5%. And that those providers can spend all that money on wages or compensation if they wish. But in the bill, it does say that it's a little confusing, but 3% would go to a workforce component, 1% to quality, and 1% to the person-centered. That does not mean that the provider has to spend the money in those areas. What it does say is if you don't do a quality component and or a person-centered component, you will lose 1% of the 5% for each of those things you don't do. I can assure you every provider will do it. Now, in terms of an encumbrance, the money that would go to must go to compensation for eligible employees. The bill, as it stands now, has 90% of that 3% that's part of the workforce component. Those, I think, are the major differences.
Representative
Council can correct me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions on the DE1 amendment? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps Mr. Nelson can just clarify another thing, in that last year in the budget you did authorize some grants for innovation in to improve quality and person care approaches, and I understand that DHS just recently issued the RFP for those grants for which these providers would be eligible, and what is the interaction that you expect between those two focuses?
Mr. Nelson.
Representative Loeffler, Mr. Chair, I'm not prepared to, I'm not aware of precise interaction. I think those providers that work, and I presume maybe you're talking about PIP grants and some of the innovation that occurs under there, would certainly qualify as under the quality component or under the person-centered component, as those innovations are pointed in that direction. So to the extent that providers are doing that, that would qualify, as I understand it, to satisfy the requirements under person-centeredness and quality.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that's something that before we put together a final recommendations, we really need to look at, because the focus of this bill has generally been on the workforce, and we did last year authorize a different approach to improving the ability of these caregiving organizations to work seriously on innovation in both quality and person-centeredness, and so we need to better explore that. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have another question about the amendment. So if 90% of, so right now the amount in the bill that must go to wages is 90% of the 3%, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so really, what does the other 10% go to, or what can it go to?
It can go to developing quality projects, person-centered projects, to cover other new costs or costs that the provider is experiencing. I can tell you this, just to maybe use history as an example. In 2014, when there were the encumbrance did not encumber all of the money, but it didn't break it out this way, but at the end of the day, as we surveyed ARM members, every ARM member, and I think this is true pretty much across the board, gave at least an aggregate of 5% increase in wages, not only compensation, but in wages to employees. And that's the reality that's going to happen this year. So the point that you're bringing up, Representative Liebling, I think is a good one. And when the bill was put together, we anticipated that there would be discussion on the encumbrance relative to the workforce crisis, and I think I can speak for the Best Life Alliance that we invite that conversation, but your point is well taken.
Representative Liebling.
So, members, when you're voting on this delete all amendment now, so, you know, every email that I've gotten, Mr. Nelson, and Mr. Chair, every email has talked about the need for wage increases. Every single one. Not one email has been about the need of the provider agencies to have more money to do other things with them. So I fully support increasing wages of the people who are giving the care. As all of my constituents have been telling me, as people from across the state have been telling me, but that's not what this delete all amendment is doing. So members, you're going to be voting now on a delete all amendment that significantly decreases the portion that goes to wages. So we're now talking about not 5%, but 3%. And of that 3%, only 90% of that money even has to be given to people who are actually doing the work of caring for elderly and disabled people. So I'm not in favor of that, Mr. Nelson. I mean, this is not what we thought we were getting. I don't know if this is what Representative Hamilton thought he was getting. Maybe he can
may
speak
I respond,
to that.
Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Life Alliance?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there will be amendments today to change the encumbrance to reflect what you're saying, and the Best Life Alliance supports those amendments. We recognize that while it's important to invest in reforms, that the overlying crisis is workforce. And in order to do those reforms, we have to have a viable workforce. And the crisis is developing. Consequently, these amendments that will be coming forward, and you can pick and choose among them, we support the changing the encumbrance from the way it is now structured.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and we worked on those amendments, but not with the assistance of the Alliance, but we're glad to have your support. The question is, do we need to do the amendment then? What else is there in the amendment that's needed if you're supporting the amendments to return it to its original status or better?
Representative Loeffler, the DE1 amendment is before us. And any other questions to the DE1 amendment? Seeing no other questions, all those in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The DE1 is adopted. Representative Hamilton, I understand you also have a second amendment, A4, that is in the members' packets. Representative Hamilton moves the A4 amendment. Representative Hamilton, would you like to discuss the A4?
The A4 amendment, Mr. Chairman, would take encumbrance to 90% of all portions of the bill, workforce, quality, and person-centered.
All right. Questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The A4 is adopted. Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton, we now have the bill before us as you have it. Understand you have some testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, we do have some testifiers. And, you know, going back to some of the questions, concerns, of course we want to get additional pay increase to individuals and base this around compensation. And we're trying to make sure that we address the compensation-related costs, including wages and salaries, but also including some of the other insurance and training components that go along with it. So that's the gist of some of the additional language within the DE amendment. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers at this time.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, my name is Pam Ganilla, and this is our daughter, Sarah, that's with me. I'm the co-chair of the Best Life Alliance, and we are here to testify on behalf of this bill. This bill will increase the reimbursement rate for home and community-based services by 5% so that direct support staff throughout Minnesota can receive a much-needed raise. This wage increase is crucial to help with a statewide shortage of workers serving people with disabilities and older adults. Currently, there are about 8,700 vacant positions for direct support workers and staff across Minnesota. The average wage is $11.87 per hour. A raise in the wages is essential to attract new workers and to keep our current staff who can find better paying jobs elsewhere. Our family is one of the many across the state who are affected by this acute staffing shortage. Today, many group homes deal with staffing program problems on a daily basis. This also affects families who are trying to need direct support staff to take care of their loved ones at home. It affects staffing for day and employment programs, and assisted living programs for seniors, and many more. These programs care for the most vulnerable in our state, like our daughter Sarah. Sarah suffered a brain injury from viral encephalitis when she was 5 years old. She can no longer speak, and we have to help her with all activities of daily living. She's very dependent on us. She wanders. We do have to monitor her at all times. A seizure disorder also creates problems. Our family cared for her at home for 25 years. We were blessed with the help of loving, direct care support staff who worked with us to care for Sarah. Two of them worked with us for a very long time, and they became a part of our family. Without their help, we could not have cared for Sarah at home. 3 years ago, Sarah moved to a group home near us. We were reaching retirement age, my husband and I, and caring for her had become more and more difficult. She lives in an ICF or intermediate care facility home with five other adults. All of them have severe disabilities and require 24-hour care. They all have high medical needs and require continual care to assure their health and safety. At this home, three staff members work each daytime and weekend shift. We were very happy with her care, and we felt that all her needs were being met by these caring and loving direct support staff. But most importantly, Sarah was very happy there and still is. When Sarah moved to the group home, I knew that there would be a certain amount of turnover there. Things went really well for the first 2 years. Then, last summer, the house coordinator and her assistant quit. Then, others left, and we saw new faces. Many of them, I later learned, were temporary staff. Last fall, I talked with the mother of another one of the residents, and she told me her daughter had been living there for 23 years in this home, and this was the worst staff turnover she had seen in the entire 23 years her daughter had been in this home. So she also told me about one of the staff who'd been working like 90 days straight because he felt he should cover shifts that were empty. This staffing crisis is also placing a real great deal of stress on our existing staff just to pick up the slack. And they are so dedicated to caring for these vulnerable people. It just amazes me sometimes. But lately at Sarah's home, there's only been two staff per shift to care for the six residents. This is the minimum staffing that they can have in order to meet their state licensing requirements. The story I've just told you has been repeated all over the state in many different forms. The quality of care and the quality of life for people with disabilities and older adults in Minnesota is at risk right now due to this crisis in staffing, and that must be addressed. I ask you to support this bill to raise the wages for these caregivers who do so much to care for the most vulnerable people in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ganella, for your testimony. Thank you also, Sarah, for coming to the committee today. We do appreciate it. Next up, we have Steve Larson from the ARC. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and I'm here representing families and individuals with disabilities. You have heard from many group homes and day training and employment programs, but we also need to be heard from individuals with disabilities as well as families. Families such as Pam Ganella, when they took care of Sarah for 25 years. Recently we had a home visit, and we had several families share with legislators the struggle that they're having to find in-home staff to keep their children or adult children in their home. And that's why this campaign is so important and why I once again volunteered to be co-chair. I just want to address briefly the quality and person-centered components of the bill. In 2014, the quality component was included in the 5% legislation. A summary of the outcomes of that component is included in your packet of information, and it's the form that looks like this with the colorful circles. In order to make the quality component an effective tool, provider training was conducted in the summer of 2014 by DHS, MORE, ARM, the ARC, and other organizations in order to make sure that providers were going to be able to comply with this particular component. And as you'll see on the left-hand side, it highlights some of the areas that they emphasized in their quality plan, such as increasing person-centeredness, improving health outcomes for individuals with disabilities. And in the lower right-hand corner, a couple of providers are quoted, and I'll just read those quickly. Normally, quality improvement isn't something we think about. It forces us in a helpful way to think outside the box on quality services and safety measures we can and should be taking on. Helps make us more accountable for the care we provide and person-centered approaches. But as also being co-chair of the State Quality Council, I'm glad that we're paying more attention to quality, and this is just one part of that. But I wanted to use this document prepared by DHS and just shared in the past month to demonstrate that there were some substantial activities that have taken place as a result of the quality component. Extensive, this is include changing people's thinking. This year's legislation also adds a specific person-centered component. We felt this was important to add to help assure providers are moving towards greater community integration for persons with disabilities. This will help the state achieve its goals in the Olmstead Plan. And we have heard from some legislators that they want reform tied to the Best Life Alliance 5% bill, and this is our attempt to do that, in addition to other pieces of legislation that we have worked on in past years in order to try to enhance quality and person-centeredness in our services and supports. Thank you very much for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Thank you for your testimony today. And next up, we have Jody Harpstead, CEO of LSS Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you said, I'm Jody Harpstead, CEO of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, a 150-year-old statewide organization where over 70% of our services support older adults and people with disabilities in home and community-based services, 75% of our services in greater Minnesota. 10 years ago, 43% of the people with disabilities we supported were in group homes. Today, only 23% of the people we support are in those homes as we've moved to more independent, integrated settings in the community like consumer-directed services and family homes, apartments, apartments with roommates, and host family homes. The cost of our services to Minnesota taxpayers has gone from an average of $42,000 per person per year to an average of $35,000 per person per year. We're working as quickly as retraining and individual choice will allow from old models of service to new integrated settings that young people growing up in Minnesota today often prefer. It's an exciting time. We're grateful for the 5% increase in these services that the legislature enacted 2 years ago, but at the same time those bills were being signed, we were heading into the most significant workforce shortage in over a decade in Minnesota, which has markedly slowed down our efforts to offer people new ways of living in the community, as our managers are overwhelmed with filling $11 an hour shifts in our group homes for people who still need intensive services. At LSS, by the way, we used every dime of the last 5% increase for employee wages and expenses. You've probably heard from colleagues in the Best Life Alliance that there are currently more than 8,700 unfilled positions across the state in Minnesota's home and community-based services. At LSS, we're doing all we possibly can to recruit and retain quality staff, including working with an expert in employee turnover and retention at the Carlson School of Management to support new employees in adjusting well to their work, offering scheduling flexibility, and using our current budget to bump wages in areas most hard hit by competition in the North Dakota border and in places where nursing homes are now offering higher wages after their reimbursement was increased last year. My provider colleagues have beautiful stories of people now living and contributing to our communities in new ways at lower cost. Our favorite is of a woman who moved from one of our group homes to her own place, got a job, got married, and now uses no state-paid services at all. To accomplish these beautiful stories, we need enough resources to provide staff to support people learning to live on their own while filling shifts in our group homes for those who still need intense services, which are over half of the people on waivered budgets in Minnesota today, according to state data. Because of the workforce shortage and other burdensome regulations, our LSS group home operations are forecasted to lose $1 million this year. I just came from a retreat this morning with my senior team where we discussed the restructuring we may have to do next year if we don't get more support. The legislature has a particular obligation to address the growing workforce shortage in home and community-based services as caregiver wages are directly determined by state funding. We're using this graphic this year to show how our sector is moving people from old models of service to new, and how we need your support in between to get us from here to there, using as much creativity and innovation as we can produce, but with as little damage as possible to the quality of our support. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Judith Brumfield from Scott County. Rochelle. And Rochelle Westland from the Association of Minnesota Counties.
We're going out of order.
I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Lisa Flynn from Hiawatha Home Care. And I want to thank all of you for your support of this bill and the needs of the people requiring home and community-based care. I know you have a copy of my complete testimony in your pamphlet, and I know you're short on time. So I come to you as a nurse who has worked in home health care since 1988, as a family member of a medically fragile client who's in the audience here today, and as an employer who provides complex home care nursing services to our medically fragile clients in the community. The 5% increase rate in 2014 was much needed and much appreciated, and was a significant start in addressing the reimbursement crisis. Prior to that increase, our reimbursement was less than what we had in 2007. Currently, rates for home-based and community-based services remain far behind the pace of inflation. With recent increases to skilled nursing facilities, the wage gap has widened even further, making it more difficult to hire and keep workers who can care for our medically fragile and vulnerable patients. A 5% increase supports in 2016 helps close this reimbursement gap so we can hire enough qualified nurses to meet the backlog of needs. As a nurse, complex home care nursing services provides patient care equivalent to that in an ICU. The biggest difference is our nurses do not have a team of staff to assist them in the event of an emergency. They are it. Therefore, these nurses must be able to think on their feet. On behalf of our clients, consistent staff is the foundation for quality care. High turnover of staff is very stressful on the clients and their families. Because we as employers cannot pay enough, our workers are going to other settings and patients are left on waiting lists seeking care. On behalf of the employers, providers are limited on what they can pay employees because how much they pay is directly determined by the state reimbursement rates. Nursing positions are difficult to keep filled due to inadequate compensation, and with turnover of nursing staff, the quality of care declines. In addition, employers have been mandated to provide affordable health insurance and to change their full-time eligibility of benefits from 40 hours a week to 30, and they are to accomplish this without an increase to reimbursement. Employers could only absorb so much before they run out of business. In 1 year, Hiawatha Home Care's out-of-pocket costs for insurance on our half increased by $108,000 a year. Improve access to care. In all the years that I have been a nurse in home care, I've never seen such long waiting lists. Right now, we have 7 clients waiting to get out of the hospital to get home care nursing services. Our list has been up to as much as 13. The reason for the wait is that hiring nurses right now to work in home care is as difficult as our wages and benefits cannot compete with hospitals, and everyone is looking to hire nurses, and they're tending to gravitate towards higher wages, big sign-on bonuses, and affordable health care insurance. So the 5% will help us be compliant with Minnesota and CMS's Homestead Plan that mandates that we have individuals live in the least restrictive settings with as much independence as possible. Please continue to support this critical increase in the bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Flynn.
Thank you.
Ms. Westland or Ms. Brumfield, in whatever order you would like.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Rochelle Westland, and I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. Today I'm here representing AMC, MACSA, which is the Minnesota Association of Social Service Administrators, and MICA, the Minnesota Intercounty Association. As you know, our associations represent all of Minnesota's 87 counties, urban, suburban, rural, union, non-union, large, and small. This bill is one that affects counties statewide. I'm coming before you today to ask for your consideration that counties be exempt from the mandatory COLA increase for home and community-based service workers. This bill seeks to increase wages for home and community-based service workers making $10 to $12 an hour. This is something counties support. We want these workers to be paid well, to be able to provide for their families, and to be able to continue this important work. However, county workers are not who this bill is targeting. This bill includes county workers who are making between $32,000 and $90,000 annually. At minimum, that is $15.38 an hour, and at maximum is $43.27 per hour. These numbers do not include benefits such as health care, pensions, and paid time off. These wages reflect statewide, union and non-union, rural and metro counties alike. They are livable wages. Counties remain committed to providing COLAs to all of their employees given the limitations of their budgets. Many counties, even in times of budget deficit, have continued to increase wages. Prior to 2014, when there was a 5% increase, cost of living increases for county employees covered under collective bargaining agreements were exempt from this increase. As a result, counties operated under the same assumption in 2014 when the 5% increase was enacted. However, DHS, after this bill was passed, provided guidance that county employees were not exempt. We believe this to be the first time county employees under a collective bargaining agreement were subject to this mandatory COLA. The most recent guidance from DHS requires under the proposed 2016 legislation that counties develop a distribution plan and obtain a letter of acceptance from the exclusive bargaining agent. For counties who are a part of collective bargaining agreements, this requires that the county reopen collective bargaining in the middle of a contract term. No county collective bargaining agreements require reopening contracts for this type of situation. Counties are opposed to allowing unions to renegotiate previously settled items under the guise of implementing the COLA, as this undermines the collective bargaining process. For counties that are not part of collective bargaining, and counties who are, this increase changes staff costs in the middle of a fiscal year. This is not only administratively difficult, but creates a precedent that the legislature may dictate the pay scale for local units of government, which to my knowledge has not been done previously. This has implications far beyond the scope of this bill. Although the department policy provides some flexibility in the COLA's implementation, literal application of the law's language without exception for counties creates two compensation levels for identical positions. No county, to our knowledge, has separate classification for employees working as home and community-based service managers versus mental health or child protection case management workers. If a COLA was applied to only home and community-based service workers, a child protection worker or a children's mental health worker would be making less for similar work simply because of the increase to this specific subset of worker. For larger counties, this will cause increased staff turnover in areas like child protection, where the work is equally difficult solely because of the state-required increase under this provision. For smaller counties, where staff work both in home and community-based service waivers and mental health waivers, counties are left to struggle with how this COLA is applied, to what portions of work an individual is performing, and for what percentage of their time during any given pay period. Again, counties are not opposed to the spirit of this legislation. We agree that home and community-based service workers making $10 to $12 per hour do great work in the community and should get an increase in wages. At the heart of this bill, it's about more than wages. It's about providing care to those most in need. We want individuals who need care to get appropriate services by trained and caring staff who are justly compensated. counties care about the communities we serve and are supportive of increases to home and community-based services. Counties' expenses in this area far exceed what the state gives us for case management across all types of case management workers. Counties invest in these services as partners with the state in providing services to Minnesota's most vulnerable populations. However, the disconnect between reimbursement and cost of services under the home and community-based service waivers increase the burden that is already placed on the property tax levy.
Ms. Wesslin?
Yes,
I'm sorry. We do need to move along, so if you could conclude your testimony, please.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So, in conclusion, we want all our clients to have the greatest care possible, and we recognize this bill helps do that, but we are concerned with the impact that current language has on counties, and it is for these reasons that we're asking that counties be exempt from the mandatory COLA increase.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll be very brief. I'm Judith Brumfield from Scott County, also representing MICA, MAXA, and AMC. My example is very, very clear in one area, that is that Scott County has a DTNH as a county facility. We currently pay a staff salary that starts out at about double our private providers and ends at well more than double the salary of private providers. In 2016, our average salary increase, not counting the other benefit package, is over 4%. If this bill is passed without exempting counties from the requirement, this would mean that in July we would have to reopen that salary and further increase benefits, making us even further in excess of our private providers. At this point in time, when we have any kind of opening within our DTNH staff, we immediately draw the staff from our private providers, whether they are other DTNH providers or whether they are community residential providers. So we're directly competing and making their life worse as you're hearing a need for them to have less turnover. So we really believe without exempting counties from the requirements of this bill, a bill we fully support in terms of raising the rates paid to providers, will further make their life difficult by drawing their employees. Thank you.
All right. Representative Hamilton, let's see, I think that's it for testifiers. I understand that we also have an A31 amendment. Who's going to offer that amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A3 amendment. And so I've been talking to staff because the A3 has to have some modifications because of the adoption of the A4. And so I would like to ask Ms. Pugnelli to... Well, maybe I should just first explain what the amendment does, and then I'll ask Ms. Pugnelli to tell us how we need to modify it to make it work, if that's how the chair would prefer to do it, because it no longer fits with the language of the bill because of the adoption of the A4.
All right. Take a shot, Representative Lee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, what this amendment does is it returns the bill to being a true 5% bill. Because even with the amendment that Representative Hamilton put on the bill, we still have essentially a 3% bill because some providers may not, in fact, get the whole 5%. And so in some locations, under the bill as it now stands, you have a 3% bill, and then only 90% of that 3% is guaranteed to go to compensation of the people who are doing the work. So what my amendment does is it returns it to a true 5% bill, 5%. And it says that 100% of the money would go to compensation. And again, as I said at the beginning of the hearing, I think this is very important because what we've been hearing and what we just heard from some of the testifiers is that the real crisis that's going on right now is in wages. It's in compensation. The bill that was passed last year to raise rates significantly for nursing homes has created an especially dire situation for people who are getting community-based services, home and community-based, because there's such competition for employees from nursing homes who can pay a lot better. And so it's really critical that we, in fact, if we're going to be able to put the money into these facilities, to make sure that it actually goes to pay the people who are doing the work. If there's another, the other needs that, you know, if they want to have quality components and things like that, that's not what people have been telling us is needed. In fact, you know, until today, that's really the first I've heard about that piece of it. So I think we want the... We want this money to go to wages. We want it to go to pay the people who are doing this really tough and important work so that the people who need the care are able to get it and keep it and have less turnover. This is not for the agencies. This is for the workers. That's how I'm viewing it, Representative Hamilton. And so I'm going to ask for a roll call on the amendment, and I'm going to ask staff to... tell us how the amendment needs to be modified in order to make it work with the bill as it now stands. So I would ask the chair to let Ms. Pugnelli give us the modifications.
Ms. Pugnelli.
Mr. Chair, members, there are a couple things that would have to happen in order to make this work. First, on the A3 amendment, I believe lines 1.6 and 1.12 would need to be deleted. And then on the A4 amendment, on lines 1.5 and 1.14, the committee would need to delete 90 and insert 100.
Can you repeat that?
Mr. Chair, members, on the A3 amendment, delete lines 1.6 and 1.12. And then on the A4 amendment, on lines 1.5 and 1.14, delete 90 and insert 100.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't realize trying to give people a pay increase would be so difficult. We've been trying to work on this for multiple years, and the Senate has demanded reform in this area. The governor's office has demanded reform in this area. And we're actually looking towards the governor's language on the quality piece and component and whatnot. We're trying to work with all sides of this issue. You know, I agree with Representative Liebling. I think you had said it, Representative Loeffler, about giving the dollars to the individuals that are providing the care. But we also want to make sure that they're receiving quality care. And that's not taking anything away from the great work that people are doing here. Nothing whatsoever. We're looking for reassurance as well. But we're also working with the other bodies to try to put together a bill here that we can get passed. So you can save your roll call vote if you want it. I'll just tell everybody to vote for it. We're simply trying to work with the other bodies here as well. So Representative Liebling, if you still want a roll call, I'll tell every single one of the people here to vote for it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. We're still trying to iron out exactly what we need to do to the other amendment and to try to make it work. So we'll just hang tight for just a sec. All right, the A3 amendment is before us right now, and the changes that we would need to make to the A3 amendment are as follows. delete lines 1.6, delete lines 1.12, and is those the only two changes on the A3? Is that correct, Melia?
Mr. Chair, I believe so, yes.
All right. Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we do that...
Representative Liebling, we're going to take the roll call.
Mr. Chair, there's another piece of the amendment that has to be done to make it work. I just want to make sure that we're...
We're going to adopt that second. Representative Liebling, the clerk will take the roll.
Okay.
Chair Dean.
Yes.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Backer.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Lane. Representative Lomer.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Yes.
Representative Murphy. Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
Yes.
Representative Schoen.
Yes.
Representative Schumacher.
Aye.
Representative Zerwas.
Yes.
All right, the A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, I'm going to bring back the A4 amendment, and I would move the following changes to the A4 amendment. Line 1.5 changed 90 to 100. Delete lines 1.12. Line 1.14, delete 90, insert 100. Delete 1.20, delete 1.21, delete 1.22. Ms. Pinelli, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct.
I ask for your support.
All right. Since this was part of the previous amendment, we will need a recall, a roll call, excuse me, on this amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
Yes.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Backer.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Lane. Representative Lomer.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Yes.
Representative Murphy. Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
Yes.
Representative Schoen. Representative Schumacher.
Aye.
Representative Zerwas.
Yes.
The A4 as amended is adopted. All right. I understand that there is an A5 amendment. Who will be offering the A5 amendment? Representative Loeffler to the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this does is it turns a 5% increase into a 7%. We just adopted the 5%. The extra 2% is the 1% for quality and the 1% for person-centered care. I do think those are obligations of the service system, but we know it's under tremendous stress. We have heard that is true. We look at the handout that was provided just today, and of the improvement strategy, 75% went to staff training with the kind of turnover we're having and quite honestly, stretching to fill shifts with people who maybe aren't your ideal first candidate. It's really critical that we invest in this in making sure that those who are caring for people who are literally lifesavers. When I was guardian for an aunt of mine, I actually for Christmas gave lifesaver boxes to all of the caregivers. And while some people, like the home health nurse, like the one that testifies, literally has the life of that person in their hand, if they're distracted by a phone call, if they fall asleep doing a double shift, terrible things can happen to the health of that person that they're responsible for. But the others care for the most important part of life. And that's coming home to a home where people know you and they care about you. They know your history. They know your family. They know what makes you smile, what makes you laugh, what makes you feel like your day is worthwhile. And you know who's going to be there to greet you when you come off the bus. It's working for an employer that cares about its employees and wants them to be the best that they can be. Not to hang on to them, but to help advance them in their careers and make them feel like every day they're achieving something important with coworkers and supervisors and managers who respect them. That's the kinds of things that we all cherish in our own life. And to come home to a constantly changing group of new people who don't know your care needs, don't know your habits, especially if you're nonverbal, is really a difficult situation, and we need to really stabilize this industry that's in crisis. And so I would ask for your support. This puts back 1% on the quality and the person-centered care, and I think will help us weather this storm. And it truly is a storm, more so in the families who are dependent upon these caregivers and the workers who unfortunately are giving up their weekends, their vacation, and doing double shifts to pull in and care for these people when there's no one else available. So I really feel like it's a good investment, and I hope you'll support this.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wofler. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarifying question. Representative Liebling, were these the two areas that you're critical of in the DE amendment?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Hamilton, I wasn't critical of those areas. I was just wanting to make sure that everybody got the wage increase. So I'm not at all adverse to having extra incentives go to make sure those functions are filled. I just don't want it to be at the expense of the workers.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you for that that clarification. Because initially when we passed the DE-1 amendment, I was a little confused because it seemed like there was a lot of opposition coming from that side of the room. And I just want to make sure that we are all moving in the right direction as far as providing quality care. And yes, we do want to get compensation to these the people providing that care as well. Mr. Chairman, I would ask that people support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. A5 is adopted. Members, I understand in the packet that there's an A6 amendment. Who will be offering the A6 amendment? Representative Loeffler to the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really do thank the testimony that's been provided today, as well as what we have all heard individually from our constituents and people in this, that we are facing a workforce crisis. We heard today that there are 8,700 vacancies right now, today. That's 8,700 people who are in a panic right now about whether or not there's going to be someone there tomorrow to care for them. The system does a creative effort of filling gaps, but that's way too many statewide. And we also heard today from a nurse that consistent staff is the key to quality care. We can't have consistency in a world in which there's constant turnover and the person doesn't know that person, their medical history, their care needs. And we also heard today that the nursing home increases that we granted last year that gave nursing homes 20 to 50% plus increases have resulted in incredibly difficult competition in the workforce and made it almost impossible for some of these agencies and providers to fill those needed shifts because they're competing for people with the same talent and skills. So I think it's time for us to start dreaming bigger than 5% and to actually solve the problem that these people whose total life quality and care and sometimes their life is dependent upon. And this amendment will direct the Commissioner of Human Services to prepare for our consideration a plan to get to a minimum of $15 per hour as a floor with proportionate increases to the people with, like the nurses, above that, but by July 1st, 2019. That means that we will have a report to consider and weigh next year. We'll know the consequences I will be introducing a bill that has a revenue source for it, and I'll be glad to bring that forward this session or next to make sure that we can step up to this kind of a challenge. But we can't solve it with the numbers we're talking about. Right now, the 5% is 59 cents an hour. It brings that average person working for $11.87 to $12.46 an hour. Is that enough to overcome the challenges that today's workforce puts in front of these people and the people who, the agencies who employ them? I don't think so. And going to $15 an hour would mean with over a four-year period of time, over this 5% would be a 20% increase. If last year we had the ability to give a 20 to 50% increase for the nursing homes, then I don't think that these people with their disabilities are any less deserving, and I think we should be able to set forward a stretch goal that says by 2019, enduring quite a number more years of tough workforce challenges, but by 2019, we think $15 an hour would be a reasonable floor. Mm-hmm. It's already the starting salary in many of our districts for jobs that are much less demanding and much less impactful on the lives of the people being served. And so, Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask everybody to vote yes.
All right. Before we do that, Representative, I understand we're going to have to amend the A5 with because of the compounding amendments earlier. We're going to have to amend the A5 and make some changes to that. So if I could have Ms. Pinelli read through the oral amendment to the A5, we can adopt that, and then we will take up the next amendment, A6. Ms. Pinelli.
Mr. Chair and members, because of changes that were already made in previous amendments, for the A5 amendment to fit with those, I believe that the amendment would need to be changed so that on the A5 amendment, lines 1.4, 1.5, 1.7, and 1.8 would be deleted. Line 1.3, it's just page 2, line 1, where 5 is deleted and 7 is inserted. And then on line 1.6, the instruction should read page 6, line 5, delete 5, and insert 7.
All right, Ms. Pinelli. We have those changes. Any questions? All those in favor? I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, is the A5 before us right now?
We have adopted it. We can amend it. So, okay. From what I understand, that's copacetic.
Okay, just want to make sure we're all back and along here.
All right. All those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. A5 as amended is adopted. All right. So we have the A6 before us. Representative Hamilton for the A6 amendment.
No, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
Aye.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Backer.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Lane. Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
Yes.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
Aye.
Representative Zerwas.
Yes.
There being 17 ayes and 0 noes, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else who would wish to testify for or against this bill from the audience? Seeing no other testifiers, Representative Hamilton, any concluding remarks?
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is something that's extremely important. Extremely important. So I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Hamilton. I needed to say something before you, and I thank you. First of all, thank you for carrying this, and I know that you're very sincere and have worked hard to make this happen, and we all appreciate that. The one thing I wanted to ask you, though, is about the testimony that we heard from the counties. And, you know, I know you must be working with them. I just wanted to hear a little bit of a response from you about the concerns that they did raise, because I think maybe I'm not the only one that wants some assurance that some of that will get worked out as we move along. You know, we all want to support this, but of course we want our funds to go where they're really needed. And what I'm hearing there is that maybe the way the bill's structured, maybe that won't exactly happen the right way. So could you just please address that for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Liebling. And you're absolutely right. We've had meetings with representatives from the counties, the unions, and others. We're still trying to find a workable solution because we do want to see these dollars going towards wages. We understand what the counties are saying to some extent, and so we're still in that process of trying to iron it out. We don't have a clear answer yet today. Before this bill is hits the House floor, we're hoping to have that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
All right. Seeing no other questions or testifiers, House File 564 is laid open. Thank you. All right. Next up, I just want to thank all of the folks who came in today specifically for this bill, and particularly for the caregivers and the families and the advocates. Thank you so much. Next bill we have before us is House File 2684. Representative Crescia, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2684 be laid over. We have the bill before us. Representative Crescia, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean, and thank you, members, for hearing my bill. And there are two amendments. Did you want to address those right away?
I understand we got an A1 amendment and an author's amendment. I will move the A1 amendment, Representative Crescia, to that amendment.
So the A1 amendment, and if House Research can help me to make sure I get this right, but one of the things that I wanted to address with foster care and child care is making sure that if you are a child care provider who is doing foster care, that you don't, that doesn't count against you. And that's what this amendment will do, is allow for the reclassification so that you can take on foster care kids and child care kids. I believe I have that correct, but I'd like to defer to House Research if that's okay.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct.
All right. Thank you for that. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We also have an A2 amendment as an author's amendment. I will move the A2 amendment. Representative Crescia, can you discuss the A2 amendment?
I sure can. Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. And the A2 amendment is regarding home visiting, a pilot program, and a grant. And how this came to be is in another bill that I have, which is the scholarship bill, we're looking at using targeted home visiting to help early education outcomes. And with my work on the Child Protection Task Force and foster care, it actually seemed to fit better to put it here so that we can bring those concepts together of targeted home visiting and helping families as well as improving the foster care. So I would ask your support in this amendment.
All right. Questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Cresha, we have your bill before us, and Sheep, you have asked for it to your bill.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I'll be brief. I have a committee as well that's waiting for me, so this is a pretty simple request in terms of what we're trying to do with a big ask, and the ask is that we look at the foster care reimbursement rate. In this bill, we are essentially asking for an increase for the 0 to 5 ages, the 6 to 12, and the ages 13 and older of almost double. Knowing that it's a big ask, knowing there's a fiscal note of $54 million in 2017 and $74 million in 18, but I wanted to get out there as the ask. I know we're laying this over and see what the possibilities are, so I would hate to come in here and not come in with a big ask in something that's as important as this, and there are a couple testifiers.
All right. I have on the list Marcia Vandenberg and Molly Kenny. Please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony in whatever order you would like.
Good afternoon, Chair Dean and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Cresha, for bringing this bill to us today. My name is Marcia Vandenberg, and I have been a foster care provider in Anoka County for 16 years, and I am here to support 2684. I find it quite ironic that we're sitting here talking about these rates, given that we were just talking about $11.46 an hour in the previous bill, and I've been asked to care for children for $18.58 per day, which is what the current rate is for a 0 to 6 child, or a child who is 6 to 12, the current rate is $22.03. So what it happens is, for $22.03 a day, according to the DHS bulletin, I am to provide all the food, all the clothing, the shelter, and there's supposed to be some reimbursement for the provider, me, the foster care provider. So you can tell that's not going very far. There is additional money through what's called the MAPC, but that's not supposed to go for any of the basics. So what happens is I get a kid who perhaps wants to play football, as I had an 11-year-old last summer. And this child, I thought this was a really good idea because this child had struggled with their academics for the last half of the last school year, and I thought a new peer group would be an excellent addition for this child. So just to pay the basic fee is $150. You have cleats, and sometimes you can get them used, but in general they're $50 to $100 for cleats. Compression shirts, because you play football in the fall and it's pretty cold, so they're going to get cold out there. Undershirts for underneath the pads that they wear, socks, outings with the team. And that doesn't include my time driving back and forth three times a week to games and practices. I live in the St. Francis School District, and that's where the child was playing. Therefore, our games are with Cambridge ICNT all the way down to Champlain. So a lot of driving there. So $22.03 a day. $22.03 a day to provide for that. I know DHS has recommended a 20% increase, which would be about $4 a day. 4 times 30, that's $120. It doesn't even pay for the basic rate. We want care for these kids as foster care providers across the state. But we are really handcuffed with this incredibly low rate that we are having to take in order to care for these children. And it's hurting the kids, because these are the most vulnerable kids who have been neglected, abused, and exposed to extreme trauma. And I would just ask that you consider a sizable increase. I know that the bill is asking for an incredible amount, but it is based on what the USDA says it will cost to take care of a child. And that's a typical child. Our children are not typical that come to us. I know of a parent in Dakota County that has contacted me here of late who has been working for 21 years as a foster care provider and has had 350 kids through their home, and $22.03 a day doesn't go very far. You get a placement of a child who has schizophrenia. The counties are very they're not wanting to give us clothing allowances anymore. Recently we got a child back into the home for the third time who had been in and out, and took the child only because the child had been there many times and feel very passionate about caring for kids, and will not take any more children at this point. Another provider I know who recently took a child into their home after a 4-month stay in a treatment center where they were getting paid $350 a day back into their home. This is a child who is receiving the base rate of $25.97. It has agreed to drive the child back to their home school, which is a 60 miles on round trip back and forth during the day, to keep that kid in the school so that they can continue to be with their classmates in their program. So my thought for you today, committee members, is to please consider a sizable increase, because the 20% that DHS is recommending is not enough, and we need to be able to provide the extras that these kids need, and the basics. The basics, it's hard to feed a kid for $179 a month, which is what we're asked to do at $18.58 a day. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Van Burk. Ms. Kinney, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Kenny, and I'm the Family Services Director at the Greater Minneapolis Crisis Nursery. And I'm also a member of the Minnesota Targeted Home Visiting Coalition's executive team. The Crisis Nursery provides targeted home visiting services to at-risk families and children, and to provide stabilizing support in their home and community. As you may know, our mission is to end child abuse and neglect and create strong and healthy families. The primary purpose of the Crisis Nursery's home visiting program is to offer intensive support to parents who identify multiple barriers to self-sufficiency, including extreme poverty, single-parent households, homelessness, mental health concerns, substance abuse issues, and issues of child abuse as children. Their situation puts extreme pressure on the parent-child relationship and puts their children at high risk for abuse and neglect. I'd like to just tell you a brief little story about a family that one of our home visitors has recently begun to work with. Most of the families that we work with, as you know, do suffer from many of these risk factors that put them at risk, but they also are willing to make a big difference by engaging in voluntary home visiting services. This mom is 23, and she has a 4-year-old little daughter named Isabella. They're currently homeless and temporarily staying in a 1-bedroom apartment with a friend and her 2 children. She left her previous living situation about a month ago due to a domestic violence incident. Mom has been meeting consistently with her home visitor for about 3 months. At the beginning of each meeting, the home visitor provides a brief summary of what they talked about last time, asks Mom if she agrees with her summary, and if she has anything to add. Together, then they decide if they should continue the conversation that they were on before, or if they should start to work on a new objective. The conversation that they were working on in the previous visit was around Isabella's behaviors and some of the challenges that Mom is experiencing. Just as the conversation gets going, Isabella comes in the room, smiling proudly and showing Mom and the home visitor that she got herself dressed. Mom tells her to go put her socks on. Isabella walks away feeling defeated. Mom looks to the home visitor confused. Home visitor sees this as a window of opportunity and says something to the effect of, "What do you think she needed to hear?" Mom paused, shrugged her shoulders, and said, "I don't know, maybe a high five or a good job." The home visitor gently then asked, "Do you think that that's something you could tell Isabella?" And Mom quickly got up, followed behind, gave Isabella a high five, and said, "Good job, you got yourself dressed today." Isabella smiled proudly at Mom, and Mom smiled proudly at the home visitor. One question: what do you think she needed? A question that could be established in the home visiting relationship. The question seems simple, but questions like these are the foundation for change. The opportunity to use everyday moments to practice that really create space for trusting relationships to develop patterns for change. Mom didn't have someone to show her how to trust what a supportive parent might look like. Mom grew up with a parent who was addicted to heroin. She was sexually exploited by her parents at a very young age. Mom spent a lot of time in foster care, residential care, and homeless youth shelters. She trusted no one. Through the work with her home visitor, she is beginning to learn how to trust, how to understand her daughter's cues, the importance of the parent-child relationship, and how to focus and create action steps for herself. This small interaction that I just described is just one of a multitude of conversations between the home visitor and the mom that will help to develop the protective factors to strengthen families and support their relationship with their child. The Crisis Nursery supports the demonstration pilot project in this amendment. While our programs are very successful, we do not operate an evidence-based model of targeted home visiting, and therefore do not qualify to receive state or federal targeted home visiting funds to support the families we serve. Our targeted home visiting services, like many evidence-informed or non-model programs often referred to, fill gaps in current model programs and employ a highly diverse workforce to meet specific community needs. Many evidence-informed programs employ social workers, parent educators, or public health nurse professionals, as well as paraprofessionals. The workforce is often diverse and reflects the populations we serve. The amendment section 1 establishes a 3-year demonstration pilot to test the new targeted home visiting practice standards with the goal of improving quality through practice and program implementation. The demonstration pilot will be implemented in up to 10 sites across the state, and each site will serve 25 families using these standards. Grants will be available to nonprofits, local public health, and tribal health departments. Pilot sites will have access to ongoing training and coaching and take part of a learning collaborative. Training needs identified by the Minnesota Department of Health will be incorporated in the pilot, building off last year's legislative action. A rigorous evaluation will be conducted at the end of the pilot to assess the implementation of these standards and their impact on the desired program outcomes. These practice standards were developed by a diverse committee on the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting with participation from the Minnesota Department of Health and partners throughout the state. We believe these demonstration pilots can provide our organization, our staff, our families, and our community the opportunity to create high-quality experience that positions us all for success. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Kinney, any questions from members? Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, not for Ms. Kinney, though. Thank you. I had a question for Representative Kreisha about the bill. So, Representative Kreisha, thank you. This is, in the testifier who talked about foster care rates, wow, it's pretty amazing that we pay such little amount for such a tremendously important thing as foster care. And I thank you for bringing this, and thank you for your efforts to raise the amount. My one question about the bill is that, well, my favorite part of the bill, actually, is that you've got a reassessment here under your part B is that you're going to basically have it be essentially a forecast program. You're going to have it go up and not just be frozen in place for forever the way it has been. And I don't know how long it's been since we've actually raised those rates. Maybe you can tell us that. But it's ridiculous that we have to come back and pass a bill when we all know that the cost of raising a child goes up. But the question I have is line 2.5 that has that reassessment, and it's based on increases in costs, except that in no instance must the increase be more than 3% per annum. And I just wonder, you know, lately we all know inflation's been pretty low, and I would say 3% would have been plenty in the last few years had we even gone up that much. But, you know, what if things change? What if we get into a situation where the costs involved in raising a child start to rise by more than that? Why cap it at 3%? I mean, is that just sort of an arbitrary number because you don't want this to kind of go out of control, or what? Could you
Representative Kreisha?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. Yes, it's better than zero, and so it's a place to start, and that's why I put it in.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kreisha, can you tell us how long it's been since this has been increased?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
I cannot. I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me. Maybe House Research might have that, but I'm sorry, I don't have the history on it.
Anyone here that could answer that question with research?
Mr. Chair, I don't know off the top of my head, but I can get that information for the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, any final comments, Representative Precia?
Thank you for your support. I think it's something we would all agree that we have to at least have a conversation about, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you for your good work. With that, HF 2684 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Members, we have heard HF 559 and HHS Finance last session and laid over the bill for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. Representative Surwas moves HF 559 be taken from the table and to bring the bill before the committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Here in front of the committee. We have the bill before us. Representative Zuras moves HF 559 be laid over. Representative Zuras, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I do have a DE1 amendment that I'd like to move.
Okay, Representative Zuras moves the DE1 to your amendment, Representative Zuras.
This amendment gets the bill in the shape which I'd like to discuss it today.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 559 as amended is the MA income and asset limit increase bill. A lot more familiar this year with this topic than we have been the last few years. The bill as amended takes an important step toward achieving equity for persons with disabilities and seniors who need medical assistance by increasing the spend down income and asset limits for eligibility. Currently, persons with disabilities and seniors are limited to no more than 100% of the federal poverty guideline, or $990 a month. And if they have a dollar over that 100%, they have to spend down to 75% of the federal poverty guideline, or $736 a month. The exciting news is after our work last session, that as of July 1st, that spend down is going from 75% to 80%, so that it will allow people to keep more of their own money in their pockets. This is a step in the right direction, but just the first and a small step. Every other group on MA now has an income limit at or above 133% of the federal poverty guidelines. This bill would allow people with disabilities and seniors with income over 100% to keep 100% of up to the 100% line instead of having to spend their Social Security check down to what that 80% threshold will be as of July 1st. Raising the spend down limit to the 100% would cost about $14 million in 2017 and about $15 million per year for the next biennium, according to our preliminary analysis. Increasing the asset limit to $10,000 per person would cost $11.1 million in 2017 and about $55 million for the coming biennium, according to our preliminary estimate. We have updated fiscal notes, I think, have been passed down in our packets. The reality is we're making individuals on MA with disabilities and seniors, we're making them choose. We're making them choose between paying this provider or maybe going to the movies or going to the grocery store or, heaven forbid, if they need a new pair of shoes. That's the the level of decision-making that people on these programs experience. The other challenge with the way the system is set up with our current MA spend down scenario is the trouble it causes with providers who have that race to bill last, so that hopefully they might be the bill, their provider bill might be the bill that gets covered this month, whereas other providers will have to track down and try to squeeze out that last bit of payment. And it really creates a dynamic between providers and patients that goes against everything else that we're trying to drive home in what should be a patient-centered, patient-focused environment. We have a few testifiers here today that can explain the impact of the bill on that setting.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And while I was out, I noticed that you had gotten up and introduced your bill. You have taken on the DE1 amendment, is that correct?
That's correct.
You didn't do anything else?
Right. Not this time.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. To your testifiers, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. We represent children and adults with long-term significant disabilities across our state, and I think Representative Zerwas did a fine job explaining the bill. And I know our time is short, so I will just
take as much time as you need, Ms. Henry. It's his time.
I will try to make a very important point about the spend down piece of this bill. This bill would raise the spend down from 75 now, it goes to 80, thank you for that last session, up to 100%. Spend down is a very confusing concept. I know all of you are quite familiar with it, but essentially what you can think of it as is this is the amount of money that people with this very low income, largely Social Security, either disability or retirement benefits, have to pay out of pocket, like a deductible, every single month. And so the money that the spend down costs in this bill, which as Representative Zerwas says, about $14 million for 2017 and then $15 million per year for the next biennium. And it would help about 11,600 seniors and people with disabilities. That money doesn't go to those 11,600 people. That money goes to give them better health coverage. It pays for those services that right now they are having to pay out of pocket for. So essentially, people would be able to use more of their Social Security to live on, which is what we all think it's for, and Medicaid, medical assistance, would pay for those very important health care services that sometimes people lose because the providers say, you know, I haven't been paid enough. I'm losing too much money because the person has to use some of their Social Security to pay rent or utilities or whatever, and they're not able to pay for those out-of-pocket costs. So this would really improve the health coverage for those folks. And, of course, the asset limit hasn't been raised in about 30 years. People can only have $3,000 a month, and that just is not enough to maintain a home or a vehicle, and we are expecting that people with disabilities and seniors remain as independent as possible during their lives. The asset increase would affect about 4,200 people when fully implemented. It would cost about $13 million in 2017, and that rises to $30 million a year for the next biennium. So we seek your support of this very important effort. We've got to move these folks forward so they can accomplish our state goal of living as independent and healthy of lives as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry, for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Representative in the committee. I'm going to have to read this because I don't do well just doing it off the cuff. My name is Lane Beckman, and I've lived two completely different lives. In 2009, I underwent surgery to remove a large brain tumor and suffered a massive stroke. Some of you might remember me from last year. Before my stroke, I was an extroverted multitask whiz. I have degrees in paramedicine and nursing. After my stroke, I went from an IQ of 160 to a third grade level. I had to learn to walk, talk, read, and write all over again. My recovery has exceeded all expectations, but I still struggle with organizational skills, have problems with short-term memory, and when I overextend, I need to go to bed for a long time to recover. I became eligible for the medical assistance, or MA, in the waiver system, the waiver services, after I spent my entire $300,000 in my 401k on medical bills. It was terrifying losing the financial security I had built up from working 30 years. I survived with the help of friends, food shelves, thrift stores, and perseverance. And I'm really nervous, I'm thankful for the MA waiver services that helped me live independently. Without my ILS worker and medication management nurse, I could not live fully. However, since my Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSI, is above the poverty level, I'm expected to live on $736 a month to be eligible for these services. I don't understand why I must live so far below the poverty level to qualify for the help I need to stay independent. It feels like I'm being penalized for working hard my whole life and paying into SSDI. The spend down is complicated. I know that. Most people know. Most people who don't pay it don't even know or understand it. Here is how it works for me. I get $1,195 a month from SSDI after paying $62 a month for my Medicare premium. I am also expected to pay $397 of my own medical bills every month before MA starts paying. This is my spend down to access MA and waiver services. So after paying my rent and utilities, I have about $86, and that's being generous, to live on. And so I just want you to know, as of the 1st, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I get my check into the bank. By 4 o'clock on the 1st, I have $86 left for the entire month. Just wanted you to know that. With no savings and little income, I can't afford a dental procedure that isn't covered. I'm embarrassed to go into detail, but when I eat a sandwich or meat, I have to tear into it like a dog. I don't fish anymore, which is where I find my peace, because night crawlers cost $3.50 for a dozen. This MA reform bill would allow me and thousands of other Minnesotans with disabilities to keep more of our Social Security income and live at the poverty level. Not extravagantly. It would also let us keep more savings to pay for things like dental work and emergencies. Please support this MA reform bill so that we can live as independently and as possible with dignity. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming back to the committee, and we wish you all the best on your continued successful recovery, Ms. Beckman.
Thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, I guess I know that. Looks like we have more testifiers.
Mr. Hancock?
Yes, sir.
Well, welcome to the committee. I'm sorry we didn't mean to pass you over there.
Not at all.
Analyst,
sir.
Just
not
for a
at
sec
all.
There.
Sacrifice is no stranger in my life, sir. Okay.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, Mr. Hancock.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Hancock, and I'm the Chief Organization Officer for a company called ACRA. And ACRA is a nonprofit organization that offers personalized, self-directed home care services across the state of Minnesota. We currently serve about 3,800 individuals with disabilities and older adults, and we employ nearly 5,000 employees. I want to thank Representative Zerwas for bringing this much-needed legislation forward. As has already been outlined today for the committee, the current MA spend-down process is one that is broken for both clients and providers. You've already heard the hardships of the low spend-down income limit creates for those that are accessing services, but I'd like to briefly explain the hardships the low spend-down income limit creates for those that are providing the services as well. When a provider provides a service to someone with a spend down and then bills the state for those services, the state reimburses the provider only for claims above the amount of that person's spend down, what the individual owes the state each month. And the state then instructs the provider, an agency like mine, to collect those remaining portion of their payment from the individual they serve as part of the individual's spend down. Now, as you just heard, forced to live off of $736 a month, it's no surprise that many of those individuals that we serve simply don't have the ability to pay their spend down or make that spend down payment to us or whoever their provider may be. This leaves the provider without a full payment for the services that they've already delivered. The provider either has to spend significant staff time to collect the payment or absorbs these unpaid costs. Both options lead to financial challenges and limit our ability to provide services potentially to other individuals. Using ACRA as an example, in addition to the high administrative costs that we at ACRA absorb in our work to try to collect spend down payments, and which can be incredibly time intensive based on the population that we work with, we also end up each year with a high amount of uncollected spend down payments. For example, we currently have a total of $106,000 in outstanding billing for spend downs alone. Of that, $66,000 is over 90 days, which means that we probably most likely will not collect it. As another example, from a provider of medical assistance mental health services, South Metro Human Services was left with almost $134,000 in uncollected payments for calendar year 2014 and nearly $142,000 in calendar year 2015. Raising the spend down limit will allow providers to be reimbursed at a level somewhat closer to the actual MA rate for the services that we provide, and will provide individuals receiving services access to a little more of their incomes each month to help them live more independently in places of their choosing, with increased job options and a goal that I know that we all share with the state. So again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this important issue, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that I can.
Thank you, Mr. Hancock.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for discussing this part about what happens to the service providers.
Yes, ma'am.
And that's something I, you know, I've been concerned about for a while. In addition to this whole conundrum, it's a really quite a thing. I think when members of the public learn about this, they're kind of dumbfounded. What? We do what?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so I'm glad that Representative Zerwas is working on this. But my question to you is, so when you have that, say you provide a service to someone who has a spend down and you try to collect it and they can't pay it, you know, what happens? Does the person, say the person has ongoing needs, do you turn that person away? Do you just eat that, you know, write it off as bad debt and then continue to give service? I mean, how is that working? Does it mean that the people aren't getting the service mainly, or that the provider just has a lot of bad debt, or is it kind of a combination depending on the circumstance?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure that it varies from provider to provider. I can speak to our experience at ACRA, is that our first response when we find someone with a spend down, especially if we know that there's a potential that it's going to be a recurring monthly spend down, is that we will reach out to that individual and do the best that we can to try to develop a payment plan for them that is doable, that's reasonable for them and doesn't force them into, you know, a deeper element of poverty. So we try to work with the individual. Our first move is not to cut the person off from services, because we know if we do that, that one of two things is going to happen. That individual is going to be forced to go to another service provider and take that spend down with them. So their situation doesn't change. Or if they're not able to find another service provider that will take them on because of the spend down, they could be very well forced into an out-of-home placement. And if that happens, it becomes a much, much more costly experience for the state of Minnesota, for all the taxpayers. So our first step is really to try to work out some kind of a payment plan for them. But of the $106,000 that I mentioned in my testimony that we ended last year with at ACRA, there's a very large portion of that that we will simply write off to bad debt.
All right. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please come forward. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, and just check in with a page afterwards and so we can get your name and address and that kind of thing. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Heidi Meyer, and I live in West St. Paul in Dakota County and get Dakota County Human Services. I want to also express that it's not just the providers not getting the money. The providers also have to do their job, because just recently, I have been paying since June all the way up to December. I could have lost my medical assistance, Social Security, my house, and my independent living services, because Dakota County social worker did not get the providing information to my independent living company, and the company did not fight for it. How I found out is when I went to the drugstore in West St. Paul, Walgreens, I had to get a new insurance, so I showed them my card, and they said, there is a problem with your medication payments. You owe a deductible, and it was over like $3,000. It was a huge amount. So we also have to look at the company doing their part and making sure if the person is paying their spend down correctly, because I am hoping that I'm not put into these numbers saying I didn't pay last year when I did pay. And then Disability Linkage Line, if you ever heard of that, had to help me figure out how to fix the problem, because each entity did not know, from human services to the providers, nobody could fix it. So they did a lot of digging to figure out why it was happening. So sometimes the person with the disability is doing everything politically correct that you ask us to do, but the companies need to own up and do their part too to make sure that each part is working correctly and each entity is following the, because the legislators and human services have put some very good stuff into place if the companies and human services would do their job.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. And were you able to successfully solve your problem and get everything ironed out?
Actually, it took many months, many people, and to be truthfully honest, half of them didn't even believe, because they couldn't even see the problem in the computer. They kept saying everything was correct. Finally, we went to Integrity Living Options, is where I get my services. And they looked into the computer and said, we've been trying to get the, you know, the thing you need to pay your spend down from Dakota County's Human Services. And then once we went to Human Services Dakota County and told them about it and got Integrity Living Options involved, then it got solved. But it took many entities to get to that point, because no one could see a problem. Our system is set up not to see things. So for someone who is doing it politically correct, is having some serious issues. So I could have lost everything that I worked hard for. But it did get resolved, but it took many, many days, weeks, months to figure it out.
Well, thank you, Ms. Meyer, for coming in and for your testimony. We do appreciate it, and hope you check in with and your house member before you head home.
Yeah, and just so you know, Disability Linkage Line wrote a very nice thing, so I can give it to my social worker and Integrity Living Options. And then I was thinking, maybe it would be good that you guys see that letter, and so you can see all the ins and outs and what it took Disability Linkage Line and us to get to resolve the problem, because it is way over certain people's disabilities understanding to do it. And just so you know, don't send us back to our workers, like our independent living person, because it's over their heads. Some of the people that they send us to help us with some of this, no, it's not going to happen very well. They took Disability Linkage Line. I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Well, we appreciate the shout out to the Linkage Line. I'm sure they're happy to have that, and we'd look forward to having that letter.
And please fund it, because it really did help.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Kenneth Brown. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and members of the audience. I'm a person with a disability. I fell out of a window when I was 2.5 years old, 24 feet up head first on concrete. But I was mainstream, so I'm not supposed to be doing what I'm doing. In one sense, but I do it anyway. The other end of not or having people have more money in their pocket, besides the health care providers and buying food, my company provides other services to fit the ordinances and things in place that people need to stay in the house, whether they have their snow removed, the grass cut, the roof look perfect, their trash cans in the right place, and other services. And it's paid a minimum, but that's something that the Lord gave me to do for people that are like me in my community so they can stay in their homes, which I don't mind. And I'm like the other providers, if they can't pay, I don't say no. No is not in my vocabulary. So if we're going to have people stay in the community, require them to stay in the community, they should be able to keep more of their money in their pocket to hire people like me to do the work. It probably cost me $150 just to load up and go to work, but I don't care. If they pay me $10 or $5 an hour, I take what they can give me and I eat the rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony. Thanks for being here today, and thank you for the good work that you do. Representative Zerwas, anything to wrap up?
Mr. Chair and members, just briefly, the fiscal notes in your packets for this entire ask for this year, for 2017, it's $27 million. For the next biennium, this entire ask is $89 million.
Representative Zerwas, not to interrupt, but that is the cheapest bill we've seen today.
Let's get it done! Let's get it done! No, and you know me, fiscal conservative. That wasn't supposed to be a joke! Mr. Chair members, when I first started working with the group, I realized that fixing this all at once in one attack wasn't likely. It's a huge ask. It's a huge lift. But what I know now, after seeing what we're going to do as of July 1, moving from 75% to 80% of the federal poverty guideline on just the income, that's $50 a month. That's what it equates to for folks that are part of the spend down. It equates to $50 a month. More money in their pockets. It's the difference between whether they get to go out to the park, whether they get to buy new shoes, whether they get to go to the movies. All stuff that today absolutely is not in their budget. And so as we move forward, my ask is, it's likely we won't be able to fund the entire ask. But if there's a way to keep moving the needle, we might not get it done this year, and we might not get it done next year. But every year I'm here, I'll be back with this bill, with this ask. So there's one really easy way to get rid of me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'll renew my motion to have the bill laid over.
All right. With that, House File 559, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Thank you, members and staff. We are adjourned.